Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hej och välkomna till Vinpratarna. Idag ska vi få träffa en dansk kultvinmakare som ligger bakom Spaniens dyraste vin och som inte minst gjort en insats för att sätta Ribera del Duero på kartan, men som också gör höjdarviner i Bordeaux. Givetvis pratar vi om legendaren, den levande legenden Peter Sisek. Och jag träffade honom när han var på besök i Stockholm här för några veckor sedan. Och det blev ett intressant samtal onekligen. Och bland annat pratade vi om just historien bakom Pingus. Vinet som redan första årgången 96 tokhyllades av världens vinjournalister. Inte minst då den berömde Robert Parker. Vi får också bland annat höra lite om hans senaste ännu ej lanserade projekt i Spanien. Intressant, ni får lyssna och se. Hoppas ni gillar intervjun. Trevlig lyssning. Peter Sisek, very honored to have you on Vinpratarna, the show. Very nice, and it was also an honor to taste your wines today. It was, I think I've tasted Flor de Pingus only before. Mm-hmm. It was great to do it again, but also amazing to try the other ones as well, of course. So we'll talk about more about that later. But how come you decided to become a winemaker? The story from the start.
The story was that my uncle used to make wine in the Graf region in Bordeaux, and when I was quite young, 13, 14 years old, we went to see him, and he'd been living in South Africa, so you know, and he had come back to Europe and settled in Bordeaux, and so I went and saw him, and you know, I just enjoyed everything about it. I thought this is great. Mm. I also want to be a winemaker. No? That was like, and from being 14 years old, and then it seemed a far fetched thing, but you know. It was a nice pickup line when I was young too. Mm. What are you going to do?
Become a winemaker.
Everybody else wanted to be firefighters or whatever. And I wanted to be a
But what winemaker. Was it that fascinated you with the winemaking?
I always liked the land. I always liked nature, and I was, you know, loved to shoot and just everything about the countryside. I always liked that. A lot, and the idea of living off the land was always something I wanted to do. But growing wheat and barley and everything, you know, it's at least how it is set up today. It's not so interesting. You don't see the end product of what you're doing.
No.
So when I came into contact with wine and suddenly saw that you actually produce something of the land that you could open and you can drink it, you can share it with friends and
enjoy
you can
it.
See it over time, I thought that was very compelling. So so there I went. But, you know, they were still from 14 till, you know, when I... It took some time and it was only after finishing school and my uncle insisted that I should come down and work for him for a year to see if it was something I liked. That it really became sort of more more.
You could. Yeah. You felt that you actually could. It could happen.
Yeah, I could feel it. I could touch it. Yeah.
And you started off in Bordeaux.
Yes. I was from 83 to 84, 85. I was working there, and you know, just doing basic work. You know, it's in the cellar and on the tractor and doing everything. Mm-hmm. So it was a wonderful time. And then when I decided to do this for real, I had to get an education, of course. And the normal way of doing it would be go to the university in Bordeaux or to Dijon in Burgundy or Montpellier. They have a wonderful university also. Or I could have gone to Davis, California, and there are many places. But again, I thought that was a bit tricky. You know, if I didn't like making wine, you know, a couple of years later, what would I do with an education as a winemaker? So I realized that I could study most of the stuff, of the basic stuff, the chemistry and biochemistry and whatever not, microbiology. I could do that at the agricultural college in Copenhagen. So I'm actually educated as an agricultural engineer.
And then you so you studied, and then you went back to Bordeaux to work.
During my 5 years study at the university
in Copenhagen,
I was not very much there. A lot of exams, but not very many lectures. I was always traveling. I was working in California. I was always out doing stuff. But I did manage to get my degree, which was something. And then when I finished, I decided I wanted to work in California. The idea was that I actually got a job at Rich Winery. That would have been wonderful. Paul Draper is still a person that I admire very much, an icon of the old style winemakers and inspired by tradition. So it would have been wonderful to work for him. But he told me that in order to work in California, it would be very convenient if I knew Spanish.
Mm.
And I had no Spanish. I had, of course, French and whatever. But Spanish was not really on my list of languages, so I had the opportunity to go to Spain, and I said for a couple of months in between, and off I went to Spain. But I never really made it to California.
It's fascinating. Mm-hmm. But when you went to Spain, did you go to? Did you end up in Ribera del Duero?
Yeah, I ended up in Ribera del Duero. That was a project there that I later helped to become what today is called Hacienda Monasterio.
So, and that was around 90.
Yeah, that was 90. Yeah. And so the vineyard was planted in 90. And so that, of course, that was a long way, and I was eager and I needed to do something. And so by 94, 95, I decided I wanted to do something on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to fall on a great vintage and a great vineyard, and I made Pinkers.
And the rest is history, as
you can say. That.
Yeah. but that is still interesting. But because why did you decide to do it in Ribera del Duero? I mean, you could have gone.
Yeah, but that was by chance, and I said I went there a bit by chance to learn Spanish, basically.
And then you liked the land.
Then I was offered to be responsible for the project of developing a winery and a whole thing, you know, vineyard and winery that turned out to be Hacienda Monasterio. And at that time, that was a huge opportunity.
Yeah.
That was like jumping, you know, a lot of escalons, no? To get to where I really wanted to be responsible for my own project.
Oh, yeah. But tell us about the land that you bought around 94 when you started to make the first 95 you bought it in 95 and you
I didn't buy it. I bought the first grapes. I knew the vineyard, of course. I'd you know, seen the vineyard and I liked the vineyard very much, but it was owned by a guy whose father had planted the vineyard in 1929, and it was wonderful, and it still is a wonderful vineyard from the aspect of it. My intuition was it could produce something really outstanding. But of course, until I had made the wine, I didn't really know how great it was, because they didn't make wine themselves. They sold all the grapes to the cooperative.
Mm.
So I couldn't sort of back trace and say, wow, the 29 is great and the other one is great and all that. So of course, it was a chance, but I felt good about the vineyard. And the first wine I made, it was just really, I would say that I never really made anything as great as that ever since, which is not really true, but it was really something. I'd never tasted anything like it, and nor had anybody else, which was probably also why it became so famous so fast.
Yeah.
It was really at that moment, and I think I always call it sort of a time capsule. I mean, if I had decided to make it in 97 or any other vintage, I don't think it would ever had happened.
No.
So it was really the right wine at the right moment, at the right
timing,
time. So it was part of luck in that timing also, but the wine was really something unique. I mean, it was totally, and it still is if you're fortunate enough to taste it today, it's still a fantastic wine.
Yeah, we'll get back to that, because it's a story in itself. But if you just could tell us a little bit about the actual place where the vineyard is. I mean, the
yeah,
climate
so Ribera. As so many other things from the Castilian area of Spain, which is the old Catholic, really conservative part of Spain, in the 15th century reconquered Spain from the Moors. We had almost 800 years of Moorish occupation of the peninsula, and these very tough, hard people, Isabella Católica and her husband Fernando of Aragon, who united the Christian part of northern Spain and decided to go and liberate, as they saw it, Spain from the Moors. We talk about 700-800 years. Huh?
Yeah. I mean,
that was
a long time.
So you can say who owns the land, no? But these northern Spaniards, they certainly believe that it still belonged to the Iberian race, and so they went after the Moors and at the same time, which was rather unique, they had a guy asking for finance to go and find another route for going to India, and he happened to find America. So all at the same time, Spain became the Catholic Spain became enlarged their area enormously, not just in Iberia, of course, but also around the world, and became immensely rich, and by marriage and intermarriage and all kinds of stuff, became a very, very big power that they had never been.
Mm.
But the place where they came from was sort of the center of the hurricane, if you can say, and it always was very backward, and devoid of any kind of riches and everything, because everything was in order to maintain this immense empire that they had. No money ever came into where they actually came from.
No.
So it has always been very archaic, but very, very pure and very, very strong. I really love that area a lot. Before they sort of reconquered Spain, Valladolid, which is our the Catholic, that and Toledo were the two sort of Catholic capitals of Spain. And of course, the wine that was drunk at court was the wines from Ribera, and the sort of rancho style white wines from Rueda that we know today as a very crisp, wonderful white wine. They were the wines that were drunk. When Felipe II, the godson of, not the, the grandson of these Catholic kings, became king of Spain, everything moved to Madrid, and our area became sort of lost in time, until the development of the railroads, and there were no way of really getting the wine out of that area, so it was sort of stuck in time. between monasteries and the local population, but there was no real sale. But the tradition of wine producing is very, very ancient in that area. Also through the monastic influence, more than 1,000 years ago, there are 5 very big monasteries along. There are much more, but in just within our Ribera del Duero area, 5 big important monasteries. Especially the most important one, which is my neighbor, basically where I live today, is a Cistercian monastery from 1156.
Oh, okay.
And the Cistercians, of course, were the ones who founded Burgundy as we know it today.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of history. There's a lot of important influence in that area, and we're just there to try to rediscover all the fantastic things that this area really has to offer.
Yeah. And when it comes to soil type and in your actual vineyards,
so all the interior part of Spain, sort of the what you can call the plateau of Spain, which is this dried out arid area, is old raised seabed. So when Africa sort of chucked into Europe and created the Alps and the Pyrenees and everything, it also lifted the interior part of Spain up to 600, 700, even 900 meters on a flatland, sort of a raised seabed. And the interior is all quite limestone influenced. So where you would traditionally plant Tempranillo would be on these limestone soils.
Oh, yeah.
All around sort of the edge of Spain and Portugal would be granite and slate of various types. And there you would normally have Grenache or Mencia or other varieties, but the sort of the interior part of Spain, which is this raised seabed, enormous area, that would be the heartland of Tempranillo. And the Tempranillo is the grape, local grape that we grow there.
Yeah. And then you produced the first vintage of Pingus, and I guess most wine interested people know that you got great reviews.
I got the first score, which was from a Barrel Ensemble. I got 96 to 100 points, but that was the first time. It was not so much the score in itself; it was more what he wrote, Parker, that it was one of the greatest young wines he'd ever tasted in his life. That he thought this wine was going to become legendary. That it had an aging potential of 40 to 50 years, and all kinds of stuff that sort of ignited the interest of, but he was not the only one, because there were all the other great wine writers, René Gabriel in Switzerland and Michel Betan and Steven Tanzer, and all kinds of people wrote about this wine as being something really out of the extraordinary, and it just helped to fuel the interest in this wine, and I would say ever since I try to live up to this to this enormous responsibility.
But do you remember today what you actually felt? So how was it back then?
It was
your first vintage.
That was unreal. It was. You never expect that. I mean, it wasn't because that wasn't the reason why I made it.
No.
I knew I'd made something that was quite extraordinary, but for the first time to hear your own wine mentioned among all the greats. I mean, it was really unreal.
Yeah, could you have imagined? I mean, you tasted it before then, but you knew it was good, but you didn't know.
I didn't know in the context. I mean, I knew I had a very classic wine education, if you can say that. My parents in Denmark were drinkers of classical, Bordeaux, Burgundy, and since my youth, I'd been not that. That I was drinking when I was a very young child, but I've been able to taste great stuff, and that around the dining table was wine, and my grandparents were also wine collectors. So I had it, and with my uncle in Bordeaux and everything. So wine was not something archaic or something I didn't understand, and I would say also the way I was brought up in wine. Also makes that my interest in wine is from a very classical background. I believe that all the classical areas arise for a certain reason. I can also see from this historic reason why Ribera was lost in the time, but for me it's like a brute jewel that can still produce something outstanding. And just for infrastructure reasons, it maybe didn't even shine. But on this context, I think it's very important to mention one thing, I think it's really important that for us in Europe, from the classic wine regions and from classic grapes, is the fact that, you know, it's not by coincidence that Tempranillo is our grape in our area. That is, you know, several centuries of selection and trying to find out
trial and error.
Where and this is not it's more an observation than it's a criticism of the modern world, if you can say the wine world, and you can take California, Argentina, Chile, Australia, South America, were developed with wines that had already had success in certain areas. So people, they would bring Cabernet because it worked well in Bordeaux, and when you're out there in the outskirts as immigrants, you want to drink something of the grape from the old areas. No? So, of course, these very well-tried grapes were the ones that you brought with you. And so they developed, but that's second generation, if you can say that. And it takes... The reason why you grow Cabernet in Bordeaux and Pinot Noir in Burgundy is that they have several hundred years of experience.
Yeah.
That works very well there. It's not the same that you take a Cabernet that has worked very well for 200, 300, or 400 years in Bordeaux and you bring it to Chile expect it to perform like it does in Medoc, no? So I think it doesn't mean that you cannot produce great wines in these areas, but they do not have the same tradition. And I think it's something we should be very careful and very aware of in the old wine world. And especially today, marketplace where the wine tradition in the modern world, there are no kind of restrictions. You can plant anything wherever you want. There are no soil classifications. There's nothing. And which is, of course, at an open world. You can do whatever you want, which is wonderful. But you also have often very different labor costs and stuff. So you also understand very well why you are able to produce so cheap wines in many areas, which is a big problem for us in our, where we have legislation, we have rules from Europe that impose on us that we cannot produce more than a certain amount of liters per hectare and all that kind. So wine from Europe should not be cheap. We should not compete with the modern world on price.
No.
We should compete on quality. And I do believe that we have an advantage if we're humble and we listen to history. We have an advantage because we have varieties that are very adapted to the place where they're grown.
Yeah.
Of course, if we want to be modern, and there was a fashion in Spain where they wanted to start planting Cabernet and all kinds of stuff to see that if it, and trying to act like a modern world country. Spain is not. Spain is very ancient, and we should cherish and really impose what we have. We shouldn't try to compete with selling the cheapest wine in the world. It's a tragedy. Spain can, because it's quite easy to grow grapes in Spain. So we can. We maybe have it among European wine countries. We have one of the lowest production costs. But nobody, because the Spanish character that I love very much, they are pretty laissez-faire, and you know. And it's just for me, it's a sad fact right now that Spain is not considered so much for the very fantastic quality that it has. It's more being drunk on the fact that it's just a cheap wine, and you know, people, and it tastes well, which shouldn't be bad. So I think there's a lot of stuff that can be done there. I'm very proud of making wine in Spain today. Even though I still like the classical areas, and I still drink, of course, the Bordeaux and Burgundy and all kinds of wonderful classical wines, I also think that Spain has, if we work in this tradition, we have a very much a place in the world.
Yeah. And what's your opinion on the Spanish wine scene in general? What's happening right now in Spain?
I mean, I've only been there for 20 years, which is, you know, a drop in the ocean of time. So
yeah, but you know what's happening going on.
Yeah,
right
but
now.
It has also been, you know, and now it's 27 years, no? But so almost 30 years. And it has been a very interesting time because it has been a time of transition. We've had for better or for worse, we had this Parker had this enormous belief in Spanish wines to be the new great thing and everything, and I don't think we ever really lived up to his expectations of what Spain could be, at least not for most of the wines. So there's been a certain vulgarization of wine. People have lost a bit the good feelings of tradition, like in so many, even in the classical areas, a lot of people have gone too far in their approach to technique and to I think that's a fact for many areas. Even in Bordeaux, probably more than in Burgundy, things are becoming increasingly technical, and made by people who are more technicians than they are actually vignerons. No? And I think the word of vigneron, which is wine grower, is something that we must come back to, because the wine is grown in the vineyard. It's not just grapes that we produce. We produce, on long term, we produce a wine.
Yeah.
And so you cannot have the same concept. What's good for, if you were a farmer, just selling the grapes, is not necessarily good for making the wine.
Yeah.
So we have to be very careful about yields. We have to be very careful about a lot of technique in the vineyard in order to make the best possible grapes for making the best possible wine in the future.
Mm.
And that is not always the same.
No, I see.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Back to Pingus then. I mean, can you describe what is it that makes Pingus such?
The very easy question or the answer to that, of course, would be, yeah, it's a great site, and it is. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But even a great site can produce very bad grapes if the grower is not a very skilled person. So it takes a lot of skill. It takes a lot of experience. And with wine, what's very difficult with wine is that you move forward but learn backwards. No, to quote Kierkegaard. No, you make wine forward and understand it backwards. So a lot of the stuff that you do right now, you will see the consequences of it maybe 10 years ahead in time. And at the same time, there are 9 vintages in between. You actually learn from what you did 10 years ago. So it needs that. I mean, this is one of the reasons I always say that I've been more than just lucky, because I was lucky to make, by pure chance, basically, or out of extreme innocence, be able to make a wine in 95. What I really, but it took me until almost 2014 almost 20 years later to really understand what I'd done in 95.
Okay.
So it's a very long, and of course you understand why winemaking is, or growing the grapes and everything, and the whole wine growing concept is something that is so associated with experience.
Mm.
So to be a young guy of 20 something and go out and make a great wine is almost impossible,
yeah,
unless there's an enormous part of chance in it.
Mm.
And so you know, you need time to understand wine, and that's why the greatest winemakers are always, you know, quite aged people who have seen a lot of stuff.
Mm.
And you know, it takes, it's a wonderful feeling when once you start to sort of see the whole picture and can use it in an interesting way.
Yeah.
But it takes time.
So, yeah. What would you say is your winemaking philosophy, or whatever you call it? What's your philosophy when it comes to
Do less.
Okay.
Yeah. Do less. I would say try to understand your land, try to let the land express itself in the most natural way, let it be, you know, you look at the soil must be very loose and wonderful and natural in it sort of. I always say we must inspire ourselves in forest floors. You go to a forest, and a natural forest. We're not talking about plantations. No. We talk about natural forest. You see these wonderful trees growing many centuries, and without any kind of input. No, there's no fertilizer. There's no disease fighting, and they all grow in a wonderful way because they're all in balance, unless man comes in and start fucking everything up. Excuse my French, I say. Yeah. So trying to understand and let yourself be inspired in that sense, I think, is very, very important.
Mm.
So the more foresty you can be, I mean, a vineyard is a plantation, so it's not natural. I'm not kidding myself in that sense, but the more the vineyard can be self-sustained in itself, the more important it is.
Mm.
And the resulting grapes coming out of that, and I'm not talking about laissez-faire, because it's not doing nothing that will help your vineyard to become a great vineyard. You have to be there, you have to prune it, you have to do a lot of stuff, but you must do it always with a big idea of that the vineyard should feel itself in a natural environment.
Mm-hmm.
And the grapes that comes out of that are often and normally very balanced grapes, where what you need to do in the cellar is limited.
Mm.
And the more you try to let the wine express itself, often the better the result is.
Yeah.
Too much ego put into a wine is not good for the wine.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting, because winemakers put themselves in the backseat, so to speak. It's the terroir that does the job, and others say that it's the winemaker. It's a human making the decisions here. Yeah. So it's
no. We have the extreme. Maybe you do not have that much in Sweden, but in Copenhagen, which is sort of, you know, my hometown.
Yeah.
Also, the natural wine movement is a big issue, sometimes I wonder. If you don't prune a vineyard, the vineyard will automatically be unable to produce grapes in any kind.
Mm.
So it will the vine itself is a lian. In a natural environment, it will be, it's a forest plant. It will grow on other trees. It will support its foliage.
Mm.
So it needs some kind of support or something. If it was a natural plant, if you do nothing to it, you know, it will, and you know, it's not trellised or pruned in a certain way, it will not be able to do anything. It will just grow into a wilderness of nothing.
Mm.
And the same with wine. If you leave the fermentation of natural grape juice or any kind of fruit juice, the end result is not wine.
Yeah.
It's vinegar. So the only true natural wine that exists is vinegar. That is what happens to wine if you don't do anything to it. So instead of being scandalized about this fact, I think it's a wonderful thing that man in cooperation with nature can produce something that is better than what nature can produce itself or man can produce on its own.
Mm.
So it is a collaboration, and it's what we call civilization. Civilization and nature working together can produce something, but civilization should never conquer nature, nor should nature conquer civilization.
Mm.
We are this strange product of the creation where man is able to have an opinion and do certain things, but we should always do that in a respect for what the creation and the idea about the creation was all about, without sounding too philosophical.
No, that's I get it. Yeah, yeah. But you work in biodynamically in some.
Everything
is biodynamic.
Not PSI, because of course we cannot control everything.
No,
because we do not own the vineyards, so we cannot impose on people.
Of course.
And the biodynamic method, which sometimes is highly controversial. It is not very controversial. It's actually, it's without calling it directly common sense, it is basically a system that is based on trying to incorporate compost, like you would have on a forest floor. The forest floor is a wonderful thing where you have the dead leaves on top that are often dry, and then you have a different sandwich level of more and more degradation. You have a lot of funky, all kinds of stuff. That also is in touch with the roots of the plant. These are called mycorrhiza. Very important stuff that can help. The roots are pretty stupid things. They can they can take a bit of water and a bit of the basic minerals of the soil, but the finer minerals and often some of the minerals that are more difficultly extractable from the soil that can be phosphorus in some kind of form, potassium, but even the smaller, really complex minerals, the root in itself is not very good at that. But when it has these fungi living in symbiosis with the root, where the fungi gets sugar from the plant, they will excrete acid that makes a lot of minerals more soluble and more easily extractable for the wine root or for the forest root. And all this you would have in an untouched forest soil. You would have that a lot, and almost within a certain area, most of the trees, they are interconnected in it through this internet of fungi connecting. And apart from the fact that it's also, you enlarge the root area highly. So it's a very, very efficient system, and you can imitate that a bit by adding compost and a lot of compost and in certain ways, bacteria and fungi and all kinds of stuff to the vineyard. Most people today don't do that. They will just add, NPK salts to the soil, and salts they are, and you can take salt yourself, and you can try it to see how thirsty you get.
Exactly.
The same thing happens to plants.
To the vines,
when you add these salts, the vines they get thirsty. So if you don't have enough water in the soil, you will dry them out basically by these things. Not with the compost that may have the same amount of nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium. But it's also liberated in a much slower rate. So the plant is like you go to McDonald's and you brum. You smack in 2,000 calories in one go. You know, you can maybe eat over the whole day 2,000 calories, and it would not be the same as you just get in one.
No.
And the plants are as stupid as man are. If they have it, they will do it. So if you can put them on a diet, the plants, of having enough to eat, but they should eat it, slowly. And the biodynamic method is not the only. I'm not saying it's the only way of doing it. And you can do it, but it's a very good kick-starting method for a lot of vineyard. I mean, a vineyard like Pingus, planted in 1929, had been very well done by people for a long, long time and everything. But, no grass, no organic matter and everything. In the end, they end up being so dead. There's no kinds of microbiological life in this soil. And as we know that the wine, not just the grapes, they need, in order to transform the sugar into alcohol, they need yeast. also bacteria. If there's nothing in the vineyard because you sprayed it or you there's no material, the yeast will not be there. No. So the more you can stimulate microbiological life around in the vineyard, the much better. If you rely on the fermentation done by natural yeast, the much better will the wine be.
Oh, yeah. So. But
you a lot of information. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but it's very interesting. But so you started when you started working with this particular plot of land,
yeah,
in 95, 96,
yeah, yeah.
You started working biodynamically, sort of.
Yeah, by 2000. Yeah, yeah. So in the end, it's like playing tennis or any kind of stuff. In the beginning, you're not very good. It takes some time.
Yeah,
it takes some time. So, and I think there was a moment where we were a bit lost. We didn't really know. At the same time, we sort of pushed the vineyard into a situation where it really didn't understand where we were going.
Oh.
So humbly, I would say that we were probably a moment where we weren't very aware of what we're doing, and we thought we were doing great, and maybe we're not doing that great. So I have much higher comfort in what we're doing now than a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Sort of a buy story, but also back then when you have released the first vintage, I think you made around 3,900 bottles or whatever it was, the first vintage.
Yeah, 4,300.
Yeah, so, yeah, okay. Yeah. But also, I heard a story about a ship on its way to the United States actually sunk.
Yeah, I mean, that added to the myth. But
how many bottles was it that?
It was 900 bottles.
900. Okay, yeah, so it's 20% or 25%. Yeah, okay, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. So it added to the myth, but it's really
Unfortunately, also took, you know,
a lot of bottles.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of bottles out of circulation. And you know, it was a big boat. There was a lot of wine. It was not just my wine on it. I don't know why people tend to talk about it.
No.
But you know, it forms part of the urban legend of Pingus.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
But
what has happened? I mean, the first vintage and the latest vintage. What has happened in I mean, with the wine of Pingus? How have you changed the process, if in any way?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, what happened to Ferrari? 30 years ago and where they are today. They are still called Ferrari, but you know, it's maybe not. Now that's a bad example, but in a way it is. I would hate to claim that we've done something drastic, but it is also over the years it's a evolution. Basically what there is that we now really understand what we're doing. Not just me, but also the people working in the vineyard, because obviously I'm not there all the time.
No.
And it's something that it's not just what we see or feel or believe. We have great people coming, not just other winemakers, but also, you know, consultants and people who are used to work with some of the greatest vineyards in the world, and they all like very much what we're doing. So I think we have reached a very interesting point of knowledge that it would have been impossible to gain the first year.
Yeah.
So,
how are you as well affected by global warming and climate change? And do you need to? I mean, does it affect your harvest time and stuff like that?
It's a good question. I don't think it affects us so much. I mean, we adapt. So I don't think it affects the wine in itself, and I think it's pretty easy to adapt. I've been speaking a lot lately to Michael Torres, who is very worried about. Yeah, he's very worried about the common effect on. I'm not so much. I agree that certainly. I mean, to mention myself, my birthday is the 5th of May,
yeah.
And in Denmark, that was the traditional date of the sprouting of the birch, which is famous in Denmark. Today, you know, I was just in Copenhagen last night. And now we are the 24th of April, and the birch is already.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So not everywhere, but you can see it. And you know, 10, 15 years ago, that you wouldn't see that. What I find extremely annoying in this whole discussion about climate change or not is it seems to be so simple and stupid. The discussion is it man or is it nature? No, where I mean, why don't we try to understand? I mean, everybody agrees that there's a change in something, but what doesn't seem to be so clear, but very little talked about or communicated at least, is how much is that due to a natural background evolution of we can go back in you know 100,000 years and see that before man really had a big influence on nature, there were big changes in temperature. Are we just in a very warm period? And how much is the of course, I'm not saying that man cannot influence the climate, but how much is that part of so because what's interesting is if it's changing right now because there's an underlying, we're into a warm period and we came from a very cool one, meaning that the cool one was the historic one, not the normal one.
No, exactly. It was the anomaly.
So what is the normal, basically? And how much is the part that is directly directed to what man is doing? I think just from a total logical point of view, the idea that we use something that is reserves, even if you just apply a very, very long time, these reserves, they will be depleted. What we do not know is, you know, how and when, and a lot of it depends on technology. But we know that they are reserves, for sure. So, meaning that they will be able to be depleted maybe in 1,000 years or maybe in 20 years. I don't want to get into that discussion because it doesn't really matter. But the thing is, what doesn't get depleted is the flow energies that could be waves or wind or solar or all kinds of stuff. Why don't we, instead of, I understand it's expensive, I know it's not very efficient, but why don't we work much more on that and trying to solve the problem instead of trying to solve it with huge problems of atomic power that we know that works, but we create a deposit that we do not even know how to control. And why should we try to deplete something that has taken millions of years to do, and that will eventually, maybe many thousand years down the line, and we're all dead and gone by then, will be depleted. Why not just use the constant flow? That's what I don't understand. I don't understand why it should be so dogmatic, why it should be so politicized, all these kinds of bullshit that's going on right now.
One last question then for you, because you mean you're working with several brands. You have the Pingus, of course, you have the Florida Pingus, PSI and Chateau Rocheron. What's in the future for you? Is you going to focus on these, or you haven't?
I have one more project that is on the launching pad. But I'm not sure if I'm going to ignite it or not.
Okay,
is a Fino Sherry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that would be sort of with that. Then I would say, okay, now I don't need more. Then I have my pillars. Sort of. I mean, basically, the idea is. Vineyard designated Fino from a very specific, you know, area and a very complete Solera and focus on Fino.
Interesting. I say ignite it, so it would be nice to try it.
No, we're on it. But you know, we'll see. We could launch now, but you know, I would like to, you know, study it a bit before we just throw it out on the market.
Great. Thank you for taking the time talking to us. It was very, very interesting.
No, wonderful.
It's
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.